Marino and me are in the same bowling league. His team's the Balls of Fire. Mine's the Lucky Strikes. That old boy's about the worst sport I ever seen. Drinks beer and eats, then thinks everybody's cheating. He brought a girl the last time. He shook his head. She bowled like the damn Flintstones, dressed like them, too, in this leopard skin thing. All that was missing was a bone in her hair. Well, tell him we'll talk. He walked off, his keys jingling. Detective Gregg, thanks for your help, I said. He gave me a nod and climbed into his Caprice. When I designed my house, I made sure the laundry room was directly off the garage, because after working scenes like this one, I didn't want to track death through the rooms of my private life. Within minutes of my getting out of my car, my clothes were in the washing machine, shoes and boots in an industrial sink, where I scrubbed them with detergent and a stiff brush. Wrapping up in a robe I kept hanging on the back of the door, I headed to the master bedroom and took a long, hot shower. I was worn out and discouraged. Right now, I didn't have the energy to imagine her, or her name, or who she had been, and I pushed images and odors from my mind. I fixed myself a drink and a salad, staring dismally at the big bowl of Halloween candy on the counter, as I thought of plants waiting to be potted on the porch. Then I called Marino. Listen, I said to him when he answered the phone. I think Benton should be here for this in the morning. There was a long pause. Okay, he said. Meaning, you want me to tell him to get his ass to Richmond versus you're telling him. If you wouldn't mind, I'm beat. No problem. What time? Whenever he wants. I'll be down there all day. I went back to the office in my house to check email before I went to bed. Lucy rarely called when she could use the computer to tell me how and where she was. My niece was an FBI agent, the technical specialist for their hostage rescue team, or HRT. She could be sent anywhere in the world at a moment's notice. Like a fretful mother, I found myself frequently checking for messages from her, dreading the day her pager went off, sending her to Andrews Air Force Base with the boys to board yet another C-141 cargo plane. Stepping around stacks of journals waiting to be read and thick medical tomes that I recently had bought but hadn't yet shelved, I sat at my desk. My office was the most lived-in room in my house, and I had designed it with a fireplace and large windows overlooking a rocky bend in the James River. Logging on to America Online, or AOL, I was greeted by a mechanical male voice announcing that I had mail. I had email about various cases, trials, professional meetings, and journal articles, and one message from someone I didn't recognize. His username was Dead Doc. Immediately, I was uneasy. There was no description of what this person had sent, and when I opened what he had written to me, it simply said 10. A graphic file had been attached, and I downloaded and decompressed it. An image began to materialize on my screen, rolling down in color, one band of pixels at a time. I realized I was looking at a photograph of a wall, the color of putty, and the edge of a table with some sort of pale blue cover on it that was smeared and pooled with something dark red. Then a ragged, gaping red wound was painted on the screen. followed by flesh tones that became bloody stumps and nipples. I stared in disbelief as the horror was complete, and I grabbed the phone. "Marino, I think you'd better get over here," I said in a scared tone. "What's wrong?" he said, alarmed. "There's something here you need to see."
"Are you okay?"
"I don't know."
"Sit tight, Doc." He took charge. "I'm coming."
I printed the file and saved it on my A drive, fearful it would somehow vanish before my eyes. While I waited for Marino, I dimmed the lights in my office to make details and colors brighter. My mind ran in a terrible loop as I stared at the butchery, the blood forming a vile portrait that for me ordinarily wasn't rare. Other physicians, scientists, lawyers, and law enforcement officers frequently sent me photographs like this over the Internet. Routinely, I was asked, via email, to examine crime scenes, organs, wounds, diagrams, even animated reconstructions of cases about to go to court. This photograph could easily have been one sent by a detective, a colleague. It could have come from a Commonwealth's attorney, or Caskew. But there was one thing obviously wrong. So far, we had no crime scene in this case, only a landfill where the victim had been dumped, and the trash and tattered bag that had been around her. Only the killer, or someone else involved in the crime, could have sent this file to me. 15 minutes later, at almost midnight, my doorbell rang, and I jumped out of my chair. I ran down the hall to let Marino in.
"What the hell is it now?" he said right off.
He was sweating in a gray Richmond police T-shirt that was tight over his big body and gut, and baggy shorts and athletic shoes with tube socks pulled up to his calves. I smelled stale sweat and cigarettes. "Come on," I said. He followed me down the hall into my office, and when he saw what was on the computer screen, he sat in my chair, scowling as he stared.
"Is this what the shit I think it is?" he said.
"Appears the photograph was taken where the body was dismembered." I wasn't used to having anyone in the private place where I worked, and I could feel my anxiety level rise.
"This is what you found today?"
"What you're looking at was taken shortly after death," I said. "But, yes, this is the torso from the landfill."
"How do you know?" Marino said.
His eyes were fastened to the screen, and he adjusted my chair. Then his big feet shoved books on the floor as he made himself more comfortable. When he picked up files and moved them to another corner of my desk, I couldn't stand it any longer. "I have things where I want them," I pointedly said as I returned the files to their original messy space.
"Hey, chill out, Doc," he said, as if it didn't matter. "How do we know that this thing ain't a hoax?"
Again, he moved the files out of his way, and now I was really irritated. "Marino, you're going to have to get up," I said. "I don't let anybody sit at my desk. You're making me crazy." He shot me an angry look and got up out of my chair.
"Hey, do me a favor. Next time, call somebody else when you got a problem."
"Try to be sensitive," he cut me off, losing his temper.
"No, you be sensitive and quit being such a friggin' fuss budget. No wonder you and Wesley got problems."
"Marino," I warned. "You just crossed a line and better stop right there." He was silent, looking around, sweating. "Let's get back to this." I sat in my chair, readjusting it. "I don't think this is a hoax, and I believe it's the torso from the landfill."
"Why?" He wouldn't look at me, hands in his pockets. Arms and legs are severed through the long bones, not the joints. I touch the screen. There are other similarities. It's her, unless another victim with a similar body type has been killed and dismembered in the same manner, and we've not found her yet. And I don't know how someone could have perpetrated a hoax like this without knowing how the victim was dismembered. Not to mention, this case hasn't hit the news yet. Shit. His face was deep red. So is there something like a return address? Yes. Someone on AOL with the name D-E-A-D-O-C. As in Dead Doc? He was intrigued enough to forget his mood. I can only assume. The message was one word. 10. That's it. In lowercase letters. He looked at me, thinking. You count the ones in Ireland, this is number 10. You got a copy of this thing? Yes. And the Dublin cases and their possible connection to the first four here have been in the news. I handed him a printout. Anybody could know about it. Don't matter. Assuming this is the same killer and he's just struck again, he knows damn well how many he's killed, he said. But what I'm not getting is how he knew where to send this file to you. My address in AOL wouldn't be hard to guess. It's my name. Jesus! I can't believe you would do that! He erupted again. That's like using your date of birth for your burglar alarm code. I use email almost exclusively to communicate with medical examiners, people in the health department, the police. They need something easy to remember. Besides, I added, as his stare continued to pass judgment on me, it's never been a problem. Well, now it sure as hell is, he said, looking at the printout. Good news is, maybe we'll find something in here that will help. Maybe he left a trail in the computer. On the web, I said. Yeah, whatever, he said. Maybe you should call Lucy. Benton should do that, I reminded him. I can't ask her help on a case just because I'm her aunt. So, I guess I gotta call him about that, too. He picked his way around my clutter, walking to the doorway. I hope you've got some beer in this joint. He stopped and turned toward me. You know, Doc, it ain't none of my business, but you gotta talk to him eventually. You're right, I said. It's none of your business. Chapter 3. The next morning, I woke up to the muffled drumming of heavy rain on the roof and the persistent beeping of my alarm. The hour was early for a day that I was supposed to be taking off from work, and it struck me that during the night the month had turned into November. Winter wasn't far away. Another year gone. Opening shades, I looked out at the day. Petals from my roses were beaten to the ground, the river swollen and flowing around rocks that looked black. I felt bad about Marino. I had been impatient with him when I'd sent him home without a beer last night. But I didn't want to talk with him about matters he wouldn't understand. For him, it was simple. I was divorced. Benton Wesley's wife had left him for another man. We'd been having an affair, so we might as well get married. For a while, I had gone along with the plan. Last fall and winter, Wesley and I went skiing, diving, we shopped, cooked in and out, and even worked in my yard. We didn't get along worth a damn. In fact, I didn't want him in my house any more than I wanted Marino sitting in my chair. When Wesley moved a piece of furniture or even returned dishes and silverware to the wrong cabinets and drawers, I felt a secret anger that surprised and dismayed me. I had never believed that our relationship was right when he was still married. But back then, we had enjoyed each other more, especially in bed. I feared that my failure to feel what I thought I should revealed a trait that I couldn't bear to see. I drove to my office with the windshield wipers working hard as the relentless downpour thrummed the roof. Traffic was thin because it was barely 7, and Richmond's downtown skyline came into view slowly and by degrees in the watery fog. I thought of the photograph again. I envisioned it slowly painting down my screen, and the hairs on my arms stood up as a chill crept over me. I was disturbed in a way I couldn't define, as it occurred to me for the first time that the person who had sent it might be someone I knew. Turning on the 7th Street exit, I wound around Shaco Slip, with its wet cobblestones and trendy restaurants that were dark at this hour. I passed parking lots, barely beginning to fill, and turned into the one behind my 4-story stucco building. I couldn't believe it when I found a television news van waiting in my parking place, which was clearly designated by a sign that read, Chief Medical Examiner. The crew knew that if they waited there long enough, they would be rewarded with me. I pulled up close and motioned for them to move as the van's doors slid open. A cameraman in a rain suit jumped out, coming my way, a reporter in tow with a microphone. I rolled my window down several inches. "Move," I said, and I wasn't nice about it. "You're in my parking place." They didn't care as someone else got out with lights. For a moment, I sat, staring, anger turning me hard like amber. The reporter was blocking my door, her microphone shoved through the opening in the window.
"Dr. Scarpetta, can you verify that the butcher has struck again?"
she asked loudly as the camera rolled and lights burned. "Move your van," I said with iron calm as I stared right at her and the camera.
"Is it, in fact, a torso that was found?"
Rain was running off her hood as she pushed the microphone in farther. "I'm going to ask you one last time to move your van out of my parking place," I said like a judge about to cite contempt of court. "You are trespassing." The cameraman found a new angle, zooming in, harsh lights in my eyes.
"Was it dismembered like the others?"
She jerked the microphone away, just in time, as my window went up. I shoved the car in gear and began backing, the crew scrambling out of the way as I made a 360-degree turn. Tires spun and skidded as I parked right behind the van, pinning it between my Mercedes and the building.
"Wait a minute.
Hey, you can't do that."
Their faces were disbelieving as I got out. Not bothering with an umbrella, I ran for the door and unlocked it.
"Hey," the protest continued, "we can't get out."
Inside the bay, water was beaded on the oversized maroon station wagon and dripping to the concrete floor. I opened another door and walked into the corridor, looking around to see who else was here. White tile was spotless, the air heavy with industrial-strength deodorizer. And as I walked to the morgue office, the massive stainless steel refrigerator door sucked open.
"Good morning," Wingo said with a surprised grin. "You're early."
"Thanks for bringing the wagon in out of the rain," I said.
"No more cases coming in than I know of, so I didn't think it would hurt to stick it in the bay."
Did you see anybody out there when you drove it? I asked. He looked puzzled.
No, but that was about an hour ago.
Wingo was the only member of my staff who routinely got to the office earlier than I did. He was lithe and attractive, with pretty features and shaggy dark hair. An obsessive-compulsive, he ironed his scrubs, washed the wagon and anatomical van several times a week, and was forever polishing stainless steel until it shone like mirrors. His job was to run the morgue, and he did so with the precision and pride of a military leader. Carelessness and callousness weren't allowed down here by either one of us, and no one dared dispose of hazardous waste or make sophomoric jokes about the dead. "The landfill case is still in the fridge," Wingo said to me. "Do you want me to bring it out?"
"Let's wait until after staff meeting," I said. "The longer she's refrigerated, the better. And I don't want anybody wandering in here to look."
"That won't happen," he said, as if I had just implied he might be delinquent in his duties.
"I don't even want anybody on the staff wandering in out of curiosity."
"Oh."
Anger flashed in his eyes.
"I just don't understand people."
He never would, because he wasn't like them. "I'll let you alert security," I said. "The media's already in the parking lot."
"You got to be kidding. This early?"
Channel 8 was waiting for me when I pulled in. I handed him the key to my car. "Give them a few minutes, and then let them go."
"What do you mean, let them go?"
He frowned, staring at the remote control key in his hand. "They're in my parking place." I headed toward the elevator.
"They're what?"
"You'll see," I boarded. "If they so much as touch my car, I'll charge them with trespassing and malicious property damage. Then I'm going to have the AG's office call their station's general manager. I might sue." I smiled at him through shutting doors. My office was on the second floor of the Consolidated Lab building, which had been constructed in the 70s and was soon to be abandoned by us and the scientists upstairs. At last, we were to get spacious quarters in the city's new biotech park, just off Broad Street, not far from the Marriott and the Coliseum. Construction was already underway, and I spent far too much time arguing over details, blueprints, and budgets. What had been home to me for years was now in disarray. Stacks of boxes lining hallways, and clerks not wanting to file, since everything would have to be packed anyway. Averting my gaze from more boxes, I followed the hallway to my office, where my desk was in its usual state of avalanche. I checked my email again, almost expecting another anonymous file like the last. But only the same messages were there, and I scanned through them, sending brief replies. The address, Dead Dock, quietly waited in my mailbox, and I couldn't resist opening it and the file with the photograph. I was concentrating so hard I didn't hear Rose walk in. "I think Noah had better build another ark," she said. Startled, I looked up to see her in the doorway adjoining my office and hers. She was taking off her raincoat and looked worried. "I didn't mean to scare you," she said. Hesitating, she stepped inside, scrutinizing me. "I knew you'd be here, despite all advice," she said. "You look like you've seen a ghost."
"What are you doing here so early?" I asked.
"I had a feeling you'd have your hands full."
She took off her coat.
"You saw the paper this morning?"
"Not yet." She opened her pocketbook and got out her glasses. all this butcher business. You can imagine the uproar. While I was driving, I heard on the news that since these cases started, more handguns are being sold than you can shake a stick at. I sometimes wonder if the gun shops aren't behind things like this. Frighten us out of our wits, so we all make a mad dash for the nearest 38 or semi-automatic pistol. Rose had hair the color of steel, that she always wore up, her face patrician and keen. There was nothing she hadn't seen, and she wasn't afraid of anyone. I lived in the uneasy shadow of her retirement, for I knew her age. She didn't have to work for me. She stayed only because she cared, and had no one left at home. "Take a look," I said, pushing back my chair. She came around to my side of the desk and stood so close I could smell white musk, the fragrance of everything she had concocted at the body shop, where they were against testing with animals. Rose had recently adopted her fifth retired greyhound. She bred Siamese cats, kept several aquariums, and was one step short of being dangerous to anyone who wore fur. She stared into my computer screen and didn't seem to know what she was looking at. Then her demeanor stiffened. "My God," she muttered, looking at me over the top of her bifocals. "Is this what's downstairs?" "I think an earlier version of it," I said. "Sent to me on AOL." She didn't speak. "Needless to say," I went on, "I will trust you to keep an eagle eye on this place while I'm downstairs. If anybody comes into the lobby we don't know or aren't expecting, I want security to intercept them. Don't you even think about going out to see what they want." I looked pointedly at her, knowing what she was like. "You think he would come here?" she matter-of-factly stated. I'm not sure what to think, except that he clearly had some need to contact me. I closed the file and got up. "And he has." At not quite 8:30, Wingo rolled the body onto the floor scale, and we began what I knew would be a very long and painstaking examination. The torso weighed 46 pounds and was 21 inches in length. Livor mortis was faint posteriorly, meaning when her circulation had quit, blood had settled according to gravity, placing her on her back for hours or days after death. I couldn't look at her without seeing the savaged image on my computer screen, and believed it and the torso before me were the same. "How big do you think she was?" Wingo glanced at me as he parallel parked the gurney next to the first autopsy table. "We'll use heights of lumbar vertebrae to estimate height, since we obviously don't have tibias, femurs," I said, tying a plastic apron over my gown. "But she looks small, frail, actually." Moments later, X-rays had finished processing, and he was attaching them to light boxes. What I saw told a story that didn't seem to make sense. The faces of the pubic symphysis, or the surfaces where one pubis joins the other, were no longer rugged and ridged, as in youth. Instead, bone was badly eroded with irregular lipped margins. More X-rays revealed sternal rib ends with irregular bony growths, the bone very thin-walled with sharp edges, and there were degenerative changes to the lumbosacral vertebrae as well. Wingo was no anthropologist, but he saw the obvious, too. If I didn't know better,
I think we got her films mixed up with somebody else's, he said.
This lady's old, I said.
How old would you guess?
I don't like to guess. I was studying her x-rays. But I'd say 70, at least. Or to play it really safe, between 65 and 80. Come on. Let's go through trash for a while.
The next 2 hours were spent sifting through a large garbage bag of trash from the landfill that had been directly under and around the body. The garbage bag I believed she had been in was black, 30-gallon size, and had been sealed with a yellow plastic-toothed tie. Wearing masks and gloves, Wingo and I picked through shredded tire and the fluff from upholstery stuffing that was used as a cover in the landfill. We examined countless tatters of slimy plastic and paper, picking out maggots and dead flies and dropping them into a carton. Our treasures were few. A blue button that was probably unrelated. And oddly, a child's tooth, which I imagined was tossed, a coin left under a pillow. We found a mangled comb, a flattened battery, several shards of broken china, a tangled wire coat hanger, and the cap of a Bic pen. Mostly, it was rubber, fluff, torn black plastic, and soggy paper that we threw into a garbage can. Then we circled bright lights around the table and centered her on a clean white sheet. Using a lens, I began going over her, an inch at a time. Her flesh a microscopic landfill of debris. With forceps, I collected pale fibers from the dark bloody stump that once had been her neck. And I found hairs, three of them, grayish-white, about 14 inches long, adhering to dried blood posteriorly. I need another envelope, I said to Wingo as I came across something else I didn't expect. Embedded in the ends of each humerus, or the bone of the upper arm, and also in margins of muscle around it, were more fibers and tiny fragments of fabric that looked pale blue, meaning the saw had to have gone through it. She was dismembered through her clothes or something else she was wrapped in, I said, startled. Wingo stopped what he was doing and looked at me. The others weren't. Those victims appeared to have been nude when they were sawn apart. He made more notes as I moved on, peering through the lens. Fibers and bits of fabric are also embedded in either femur. I looked more closely. So she was covered from the waist down, too, he said. That's the way it's looking. So someone waited until after she was dismembered, and then took all her clothes off? He looked at me, emotion in his eyes as he started to envision it. He wouldn't want us to get the clothes. There might be too much information there, I said. Then why didn't he undress her, unwrap her, or whatever to begin with? Maybe he didn't want to look at her while he was dismembering her, I said. Oh, so now he's getting sensitive on us, Wingo said, as if he hated whoever it was. Make a note of the measurements, I told him. Cervical spine is transected at the level of C5. Residual femur on the right measures 2 inches below the lesser trochanter, and 2.5 inches on the left, with saw marks visible. Right and left segments of humerus are 1 inch, saw marks visible. On the upper right hip is a 3/4 inch old healed vaccination scar. What about that? He referred to the numerous raised, fluid-filled vesicles scattered over buttocks, shoulders, and upper thighs. I don't know.
I said, reaching for a syringe. I'm guessing herpes zoster virus.
Whoa!
Wingo jumped back from the table. I wish you told me that earlier. He was scared. Shingles. I began labeling a test tube. Maybe. I must confess it's a little weird.
What do you mean?
He was getting more unnerved. With shingles, I replied, the virus attacks sensory nerves. When the vesicles erupt, they do so in a swath along nerve distributions, under a rib, for example. And the vesicles will be of varying ages. But this is a crop, and they all look the same age.
What else could it be?
He asked. Chickenpox?
Same virus.
Children get chickenpox. Adults get shingles.
What if I get it?
Wingo said. Did you have chickenpox as a kid?
Got no idea.
What about the VZV vaccine? I asked. Have you had that?
No.
Well, if you have no antibody to VZV, you should be vaccinated. I glanced up at him. Are you immunosuppressed? He didn't say anything as he went to a cart, snatching off his latex gloves and slamming them into the red can for biologically hazardous trash. Upset, he snatched a new pair made of heavier blue nitrile. I stopped what I was doing, watching him until he returned to the table.
I just think you could have warned me before now, he said, and he sounded on the verge of tears. I mean, it's not like you can take any precautions in this place, like vaccinations, except for hepatitis B. So I depend on you to let me know what's coming in.
Calm down. I was gentle with him. Wingo was too sensitive for his own good, and that was really the only problem I ever had with him. You can't possibly get chickenpox or shingles from this lady unless you've had an exchange of body fluids, I said. So as long as you're wearing gloves and going about business in the usual way, and don't cut yourself or get a needle stick, you will not be exposed to the virus. For an instant, his eyes were bright, and he quickly looked away.
I'll start taking pictures, he said.
Chapter 4 Marino and Benton Wesley appeared mid-afternoon, when the autopsy was well underway. There was nothing further I could do with the external examination, and Wingo had taken a late lunch, so I was alone. Wesley's eyes were on me as he walked through the door, and I could tell by his coat that it was still raining.
"Just so you know," Marino said right off, "there's a flood warning."
Since there were no windows in the morgue, I never knew the weather. "How serious a warning?" I asked, and Wesley had come close to the torso and was looking at it.
"Serious enough that if this keeps up, somebody better start piling up sandbags,"
Marino replied as he parked his umbrella in a corner. My building was blocks from the James. Years ago, the lower level had flooded. Bodies donated to science rising in overflowing vats. Water poisoned pink with formalin, seeping into the morgue and the parking lot and back. "How worried should I be?" I asked with concern.
"It's going to stop," Wesley said, as if he could profile the weather, too.
He took off his raincoat, and the suit beneath it was a dark blue that was almost black. He wore a starched white shirt and conservative silk tie, his silver hair a little longer than usual, but neat. His sharp features made him seem even keener and more intimidating than he was. But today his face was grim, and not just because of me. He and Marino went to a cart to put on gloves and masks.
"I'm sorry we're late," Wesley said to me as I continued working. "Every time I tried to get away from the house, the phone rang. This thing's a real problem."
"Certainly for her it is," I said.
"Shit." Marino stared at what was left of a human being. "How the hell does anybody do something like that?"
"I'll tell you how," I said, cutting sections of spleen. "First you pick an old woman and make sure she isn't properly watered or fed. And when she gets sick, forget medical care. Then you shoot or beat her in the head."
I glanced up at them.
"My bet is that she has a basilar skull fracture. Maybe some other type of trauma."
Marino looked baffled.
"She doesn't have a head. How can you say that?"
"I can say it because there's blood in her airway." They got closer to see what I was talking about.
"One way that could have happened," I went on, "is if she had a basilar skull fracture and blood dripped down the back of her throat, and she aspirated it into her airway."
Wesley looked carefully at the body, with the demeanor of one who has seen mutilation and death a million times. He stared at the space where the head should be, as if he could imagine it.
"She has hemorrhage in muscle tissue."
I paused to let this sink in.
"She was still alive when the dismemberment began."
"Jesus Christ!"
Marino exclaimed in disgust as he lit a cigarette.
"Don't tell me that!"
"I'm not saying she was conscious," I added. "Most likely, this was at or about the time of death. But she still had a blood pressure, feeble as it might have been. This was true around the neck, anyway, but not the arms and legs."
"Then he severed her head first," Wesley said to me.
"Yes." He was scanning X-rays on the walls.
"This doesn't fit with his victimology," he said. "Not at all."
"Everything about this case doesn't fit," I replied, "except that once again a saw was used. I've also found some cuts on the bone that are consistent with a knife."
"What else can you tell us about her?" Wesley said, and I could feel his eyes on me as I dropped another section of organ into the stock jar of formalin.
"She has some sort of eruptions that might be shingles, and two scars of the right kidney that would indicate pyelonephritis, or kidney infection. Cervix is elongated and stellate, which could suggest she's had children. Her myocardium, or heart muscle, is soft."
"Meaning?"
"Toxins do that. Toxins produced by microorganisms." I looked up at him. "As I've mentioned, she was sick."
Marino was walking around, looking at the torso from different angles.
"Do you have any idea with what?"
"Based on secretions in her lungs, I know she had bronchitis. At the moment, I don't know what else, except her liver's in pretty grim shape."
"From drinking," Wesley said.
"Yellowish, nodular, yes," I said. "And I would say that at one time she smoked."
"She's skin and bones," Marino said.
"She wasn't eating," I said. "Her stomach is tubular, empty and clean." I showed them. Wesley moved to a nearby desk and pulled out a chair. He stared off in thought as I yanked a cord down from an overhead reel and plugged in the Striker saw. Marino, who liked this part of the procedure the least, stepped back from the table. No one spoke as I sawed off the ends of arms and legs, a bony dust drifting on the air. The electric whir louder than a dentist drill.
I placed each section into a labeled carton and said what I thought.
I don't think we're dealing with the same killer this time.
I don't know what to think, Marino said. But we got two big things in common, a torso, and it was dumped in Central Virginia.
He's had a varied victimology all along, said Wesley, wearing his surgical mask loose around his neck. One black, two whites, all female, and one black male. The five in Dublin were mixed as well. But again, all were young.
So would you now expect him to choose an old woman? I asked him.
Frankly, I wouldn't. But these people aren't an exact science, Kay. This is somebody who does whatever the hell he feels like whenever he feels like it.
The dismemberment isn't the same. It's not through the joints, I reminded them. And I think she was clothed or wrapped in something.
This one may have bothered him more, Wesley said, taking the mask off altogether and dropping it on top of the desk. His urge to kill again may have been overwhelming, and she may have been easy.
He looked at the torso.
So he strikes, but his M.O. shifts because the victimology has suddenly shifted, and he doesn't really like it. He leaves her at least partially dressed or covered, because raping and killing an old woman aren't what turn him on. And he cuts off her head first, so he doesn't have to look at her.
You see any sign of rape? Marino asked me.
You rarely do, I said. I'm about to finish up here. She'll go in the freezer like the other ones in the hope we eventually get an identification. I've got muscle tissue and marrow for DNA, hoping that we'll eventually have a missing person to compare it with. I was discouraged, and it showed. Wesley collected his coat from the back of a door, leaving a small puddle on the floor.
I'd like to see the photograph sent to you over AOL, he said to me.
That doesn't fit the M.O. either, by the way, I said as I began suturing the Y incision. I wasn't sent anything in the earlier cases. Marino was in a hurry, as if he had somewhere else to go.
I'm heading out to Sussex, he said, walking to the door. Gotta meet Lone Ranger Ring so he can give me lessons in how to investigate homicides.
He abruptly left, and I knew the real reason why. Despite his preaching to me about marriage, my relationship with Wesley secretly bothered Marino. A part of him would always be jealous.
Rose can show you the photograph, I said to Wesley as I washed the body with hose and sponge. She knows how to get into my email.
Disappointment glinted in his eyes before he could mask it. I carried the cartons of bone ends to a distant counter, where they would be boiled in a weak solution of bleach to completely deflesh and degrease them. He stayed where he was, waiting, and watching until I got back. I didn't want him to go, but I didn't know what to do with him anymore.
"Can't we talk, Kay?" he finally said. "I've hardly seen you. Not in months. I know we're both busy, and this isn't a good time, but..."
"Benton," I interrupted with feeling.
"Not here."
"Of course not. I'm not suggesting we talk here."
"It will just be more of the same."
"I promise it won't."
He checked the clock on the wall.
"Look, it's already late. Why don't I just stay in town? We'll have dinner."
I hesitated, ambivalence bouncing from one end of my brain to the other. I was afraid to see him, and afraid not to see him.
"All right," I said. "My house at 7.
I'll throw together something. Don't expect much.
I can take you out.
I don't want you to go to any trouble.
The last place I want to be right now is out in public, I said. His eyes lingered on me a little longer as I labeled tags and tubes and various types of containers. The strike of his heels was sharp on tile as he left, and I heard him speak to someone as elevator doors opened in the hall. Seconds later, Wingo walked in.
I would have got here sooner.
He went to a cart and began putting on new shoe covers, mask, and gloves.
But it's a zoo upstairs.
What's that supposed to mean? I asked, untying my gown and back as he slipped into a fresh one.
Reporters.
He put on a face shield and looked at me through clear plastic.
In the lobby.
Casing the building in their television vans. He looked tensely at me.
Hate to tell you, but now Channel 8's got you blocked in. Their van's right behind your car so you can't get out, and nobody's in it.
Anger rose like heat. Call the police and get them towed, I said from the locker room. You finish up here. I'm going upstairs to take care of this. Slamming my balled-up gown into the laundry bin, I pulled off gloves, shoe covers, and cap. I vigorously scrubbed with antibacterial soap and yanked open my locker, my hands suddenly clumsy. I was very upset, this case, the press, Wesley, everything getting to me.
Dr. Scarpetta?
Wingo was suddenly in the doorway as I fumbled with buttons on my blouse. And his walking in on me while I was dressing was nothing new. It never bothered either of us, for I was as comfortable with him as I would be with a woman.
I was wondering if you had time.
He hesitated.
Well, I know you're busy today.
I tossed bloody Reeboks into my locker and slipped on the shoes I had worn to work. Then I put on my lab coat.
Actually, Wingo,
I checked my anger so I didn't take it out on him. I'd like to talk to you, too. When you finish down here, come see me in my office. He didn't have to tell me. I had a feeling I knew. I rode the elevator upstairs, my mood darkened like a storm about to strike. Wesley was still in my office, studying what was on my computer screen, and I walked past in the hallway without slowing my stride. It was Rose I wanted to find. When I got to the front office, clerks were frantically answering phones that wouldn't stop, while my secretary and administrator were before a window overlooking the front parking lot. The rain hadn't relented, and this hadn't seemed to deter a single journalist, cameraman, or photographer in this town. They seemed crazed, as if the story must be huge for everyone else to be braving a downpour. "Where are Fielding and Grant?" I asked about my deputy chief and this year's fellow. My administrator was a retired sheriff who loved cologne and snappy suits. He stepped away from the window while Rose continued to look out.
"Dr. Fielding's in court," he said. "Dr. Grant had to leave because his basement's flooding."
Rose turned around with the demeanor of one ready to fight, as if her nest had been invaded.
"I put Jess in the filing room," she said of the receptionist.
"So there's no one out front." I looked toward the lobby.
"Oh, there are plenty of people, all right," my secretary angrily said as phones rang and rang. "I didn't want anybody sitting out there with all those vultures. I don't care if there is bulletproof glass."
"How many reporters are in the lobby?"
15, maybe 20, last I checked," my administrator answered. "I went out there once and asked them to leave. They said they weren't going until they had a statement from you. So I thought we could write something up and..."
I'll give them a statement, all right, I snapped.
Rose put her hand on my arm.
Dr. Scarpetta, I'm not sure it's a good idea.
I interrupted her, too.
Leave this to me.
The lobby was small, and the thick glass partition made it impossible for any unauthorized person to get in. When I rounded the corner, I could not believe how many people were crammed into the room, the floor filthy with footprints and dirty puddles. As soon as they saw me, camera lights blazed. Reporters began shouting, shoving microphones and tape recorders close as flash guns went off in my face. I raised my voice above all of them.
Please, quiet.
Dr. Scarpetta,
quiet,
I said more loudly as I blindly stared out at aggressive people I couldn't make out.
Now, I am going to ask you politely to leave, I said.
Is it the butcher again?
A woman raised her voice above the rest.
Everything is pending further investigation, I said.
Dr. Scarpetta.
I could just barely make out the television reporter as Patty Denver, whose pretty face was on billboards all over the city.
Sources say you're working this as another victim in these serial killings, she said. Can you verify that?
I didn't respond.
Is it true the victim is Asian, probably prepubescent, and came off a truck that is local?
She went on to my dismay.
And are we to assume that the killer may now be in Virginia?
Is the butcher killing in Virginia now? Possible he deliberately wanted the other bodies dumped here?
I held up a hand to quiet them. This is not the time for assumptions, I said. I can tell you only that we are treating this as a homicide. The victim is an unidentified white female. She is not prepubescent, but an older adult. And we encourage people who might have information to call this office or the Sussex County Sheriff's Department.
What about the FBI?
The FBI is involved, I said.
Then are you treating this as the butcher?
Turning around, I entered a code on a keypad and the lock clicked free. I ignored the demanding voices, shutting the door behind me, my nerves humming with tension as I walked quickly down the hall. When I entered my office, Wesley was gone, and I sat behind my desk. I dialed Marino's pager number, and he called me right back.
For God's sake, these leaks have got to stop, I exclaimed over the line.
We know damn well who it is, Marino irritably said.
Ring.
I had no doubt, but couldn't prove it.
The drone was supposed to meet me at the landfill. That was almost an hour ago, Marino went on.
It doesn't appear the press had any trouble finding him. I told him what sources allegedly had divulged to a television crew.
Goddamn idiot, he said.
Find him and tell him to keep his mouth shut, I said. Reporters have practically put us out of business today. And now the city's going to believe there's a serial killer in their midst.
Yeah, well, unfortunately that part could be true, he said.
I can't believe this. I was only getting angrier. I have to release information to correct misinformation. I can't be put in this position, Marino.
Don't worry. I'm going to take care of this and a whole lot more, he promised. I don't guess you know.
Know what?
Rumor has it that Ring's been seeing Patty Denver.
I thought she was married, I said, as I envisioned her from a few moments earlier.
She is, he said.
I began dictating case 1930-97. Trying to focus my attention on what I was saying and reading from my notes. The body was received, pouched, and sealed, I said into the tape recorder, rearranging paperwork smeared with blood from Wingo's gloves. The skin is doughy. The breasts are small, atrophic, and wrinkled. There are skin folds over the abdomen, suggesting of prior weight loss. Dr. Scarpetta? Wingo was poking his head in the doorway. Oops, sorry, he said when he realized what I was doing. I guess now's not a good time. Come in, I said with a weary smile. Why don't you shut the door? He did, and closed the one between my office and Rose's, too. Nervously, he pulled the chair close to my desk, and he was having a hard time meeting my eyes. Before you start, let me. I was firm but kind. I've known you for many years, and your life is no secret to me. I don't make judgments. I don't label. In my mind, there are only two categories of people in this world, those who are good and those who aren't. But I worry about you because your orientation places you at risk. He nodded. I know, he said, eyes bright with tears. If you're immunosuppressed, I went on, you need to tell me. You probably shouldn't be in the morgue, at least not for some cases. I'm HIV positive. His voice trembled and he began to cry. I let him go for a while, his arms over his face, as if he couldn't bear for anyone to see him. His shoulders shook, tears spotting his greens as his nose ran. Getting up with a box of tissues, I went over to him. Here. I set the tissues nearby. It's all right. I put my arm around him and let him weep. Wingo, I want you to try to get hold of yourself so we can talk about this, okay? He nodded, blowing his nose and wiping his eyes. For a moment, he nuzzled his head against me, and I held him like a child. I gave him time before I faced him straight on, gripping his shoulders. Now is the time for courage, Wingo, I said. Let's see what we can do to fight this thing. I can't tell my family, he choked. My father hates me anyway. And when my mother tries, he gets worse. To her, you know? I moved a chair close. What about your friend? We broke up. But he knows. I just found out a couple weeks ago. You've got to tell him, and anybody else you've been intimate with, I said. It's only fair. If someone had done that for you, maybe you wouldn't be sitting here now crying. He was silent, staring down at his hands. Taking a deep breath, he said, I'm going to die, aren't I? We're all going to die, I gently told him. Not like this. It could be like this, I said. Every physical I get, I'm tested for HIV. You know what I'm exposed to. What you're going through could be me. He looked up at me, his eyes and cheeks burning. If I get AIDS, I'm going to kill myself. No, you're not, I said. He began to cry again. Dr. Scarpetta, I can't go through it. I don't want to end up in one of those places, a hospice, the fan-free clinic, in a bed next to other dying people I don't know. Tears flowed, his face tragic and defiant. I'll be all alone just like I've always been. Listen. I waited until he calmed down. You will not go through this alone.
You have me. He dissolved in tears again, covering his face and making sounds so loud I was certain they could be heard in the hall. I will take care of you, I promised as I got up. Now, I want you to go home. I want you to do what's right and tell your friends. Tomorrow, we'll talk more and figure out the best way to handle this. I need the name of your doctor and permission to talk to him or her.
Dr. Alan Riley, at MCV.
I nodded. I know him, and I want you to call him first thing in the morning. Let him know I'll be contacting him and that it's all right for him to talk to me.
Okay.
He looked furtively at me.
But you'll be... You won't tell anyone.
Of course not, I said with feeling.
I don't want anyone here to know. Or Marino. I don't want him to.
No one will know, I said. At least not from me. He slowly got up and stepped toward the door with the unsteadiness of someone drunk or dazed.
You won't fire me, will you?
His hand was on the knob as he cast bloodshot eyes my way. Wingo, for God's sake, I said with quiet emotion. I would hope you would think more of me than that. He opened the door.
I think more of you than anyone.
Tears spilled again, and he wiped them on his scrubs, exposing his thin, bare belly.
I always have.
His footsteps were rapid in the hall as he almost ran, and the elevator bell rang. I listened as he left my building for a world that didn't give a damn. I rested my forehead on my fist and shut my eyes. Dear God, I muttered. Please help. Chapter 5. The rain was still heavy as I drove home, and traffic was terrible because an accident had closed lanes in both directions on I-64. There were fire trucks and ambulances, rescuers prying open doors and hurrying with stretchers and boards. Broken glass glistened on wet pavement. Drivers slowing to stare at injured people. One car had flipped multiple times before catching fire.